Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I start today's program with an annual tribute to May Day, which I wrote, May Day 2021. A call for rebellion, a call for change, a call for help. May Day, the ancient celebration of spring, the festival of rebirth. May Day is celebrated all over the world in every culture and kitchen. For many, it is Labor Day in honor of the anonymous billions who break their backs or wear out their brains and nerves for their daily bread. It is the symbol of seeding the earth in hope for a good harvest to ease the dreadful hunger that stalks the human race. May Day is also a day of revolution, a charge against history that demands sweeping changes among the world's societies. This claim usually originates from compassion and the perception that there is no excuse for anyone to go hungry, be without shelter, or denied adequate health and medical care. It is the demand for freedom and respect for all the world's people. The world situation perpetually eludes optimists and idealists. The balance of wealth and distribution of resources is dismally inequitable, which intensifies the disparity between rich and poor. Millions of lives are ruined by poverty, oppression, and tyranny. The future blows a sour breath at the discomposed present. Humanity's probable proximity to extinction is not from any single cause or combination of intrinsic calamities, but instead a caustic, balky disinclination to change direction or undo the damage. For the past year, the entire planet has been contaminated by plague, a near collapse of human culture by a festering, virulent virus that invisibly contaminates the very air we breathe and has perniciously spread across the world like a poisoned wind. The unseen malignance is regerminated by human breath. We are the mortally contaminated carriers and spreaders of the biocidal virus, which flits among us with the feathery overture of agonizing death. Yet optimism persists. Vaccine cures have been developed in this second year of the plague. Perhaps because even in the worst times, our predecessors always raised a maypole for themselves and their children to dance around. Perhaps especially in the worst times, it is necessary to hope. And that was May Day. And if it sounds familiar, I revise it every year at this time. And now, the Vietnam War ended tomorrow, 46 years ago, on April 30th, 1975. America cannot easily dismiss the Vietnam War and the peasant Vietnamese people who refused to be done in by the tremendous suffering inflicted on them. Nor can America dismiss its soldiers who inflicted the misery. I wrote the following for my now expired newspaper, the North Coast Times Eagle, on an earlier anniversary of the war's end. I call it Winter Soldiers. If you were defeated, you were defeated by yourselves, General Vo Nguyen Giap said to the French after he accepted their surrender at Dien Bien Phu 67 years ago in May 1954. He might have said the same of the Americans 21 years later when they retreated from Vietnam in 1975. He would not have meant the anti-war movement that is often blamed for the loss of the war, but the arrogant, stupid, and ultimately disastrous political and military policies and strategies that the anti-war movement was originated to counteract. Veterans of the war joined the movement. They were, as Thomas Paine would probably have said of them, winter soldiers, bitterly in contrast to sunshine patriots. At some point in time, although the killing did not stop, the war in Vietnam was declared over. The last American soldiers came home. One of them wrote on a wall of Saigon's Tansanut Airport, "Will the last American please turn out the light at the end of the tunnel?" There never was a light, only a long tunnel into which millions disappeared, among them nearly 60,000 Americans. Another 300,000 were wounded, thousands of them returning without legs, arms, or genitals. Thousands more were paralyzed, physically and psychologically. They came back singly at first, random leaves scattered by military winds throughout the country. For the greater part of the decade of massive escalation that swallowed American troops into the Southeast Asia War, hundreds of thousands of young men went to war and returned daily almost without notice. The dead and wounded returned unseen. The wounded overflowed U.S. military hospitals in Asia and Europe. The most critically injured eventually flown to stateside hospitals near their homes where possible, but more likely they wound up in VA hospitals too poorly funded and understaffed to adequately care for them. The dead came back and invisibly crossed the country in the mail cars of trains or baggage compartments of airplanes. Rarely have the soldiers of an American army slunk as quietly back home from a war, desiring for the most part to be left in obscurity. In previous wars, they came back to parades and exultant crowds. Even the defeated Confederate army, broken and tattered, maintained a bitter, noble pride that hardly gave ground to northern carpetbaggers. Veterans of wars similar to Vietnam, the so-called Philippine insurrection, the Caribbean Banana Wars, never felt a need to justify their participation in unpopular wars, as did many Vietnam veterans. Although the vets were probably never spit upon, the continuing popularity of the myth that they were is a template of Vietnam's unpopularity, as well as open scorn for its soldiers. Five presidents tried to keep the Vietnam War from upsetting the citizenry. They promised guns and butter while taking the country's sons and money. They lied about the war from the beginning. When the French fell at Dien Bien Phu in May 1954 until the fall of Saigon on the last day of April 1975. Night after night, the American public was numbed to the war by the artifice of television news. Yet few ever saw any of their war dead. The sight of dead or wounded Americans was considered bad for morale. Death was edited out, at least for U.S. dead. The war was computed on body counts of dead Vietnamese. People who should have known better often asked, why are so many young guys in wheelchairs? The families knew, but they could never quite relate to exactly what happened to their healthy sons who were suddenly dead or crippled. They knew that one cross among the hundreds of thousands of identical white crosses at national military cemeteries, such as Arlington or Punch Bowl, covered the corpse of their kin. They knew that one of the inert bodies among the hundreds of thousands lying in row upon row of hospital beds was one of theirs. But that was all they knew. Even the older veterans from other wars could never quite understand what happened to these young men who had returned addicted to heroin, who grew beards and long hair, and often took to the streets in opposition to the war they had fought in. When Richard Nixon countered the growing dissent against the war with his Vietnamization program, diffusing the protest by pulling out Americans and leaving Vietnamese to die for U.S. foreign policy, the troops came back in greater numbers. At first, ceremonies were held for public consumption. Starched military units stood at attention with their banners in front of television cameras, visible proof that America's young men were on the way home. There was a brief flurry of interest, which settled down until the spectacle of the freed POWs was celebrated to justify the entire policy of 20 years at war, taking into account America's involvement since the capitulation of the French in 1954. Only once in all those years did the veterans become visible enough to be heard, and it was in dissent against the war, when 1,000 combat survivors gathered in Washington, D.C. in the spring of 1971 and hurled their war medals at Congress. Vietnam veterans had been pitied more as pliant fools or for pathological tendencies than they were honored in the old traditional manner. Raised voices insisted Vietnam veterans are either heroes and patriots or butchers and baby killers. They returned to a country that did not understand them, a society that was embarrassed and disturbed by them. They were comparable in that sense to the draft resistors who chose prison or exile rather than fight in the war, and to the deserters who either refused to be shipped overseas or chose exile after they returned. Ironically, it was the veterans, not the five presidential administrations, which created and continued the war for almost two decades, who were held responsible for the tragic debacle in Southeast Asia. The veterans were shunned as the nation's scapegoats, as if they were personally responsible for the disastrous policies and failed strategies that lost the war. The reality of Vietnam's consequences goes beyond the suffering of its soldiers or the Vietnamese with whom they are so intimately linked in terror, shame, and death. Vietnam veterans do not represent a lost war so much as they are the nation's conscience in an affair in which the nation refused for too long to act morally against a pervasive and systematic destruction of a people and a culture considered inferior and of merely strategic consideration, and as a result eroded much of its own integrity. The Vietnam War was ambiguous and off-center. Like Korea, it was a low-stake war, more bluff than real cards in a worldwide Cold War that threatened nuclear oblivion, though hundreds of thousands of real persons perished and anonymous millions were handicapped for life, psychologically as well as physically. The U.S. lost the war long before it ever committed its armies. It was the wrong Rubicon, the wrong dream of empire in a world weary of empires. The war unearthed the deadly rot at the core of the nation's history, and its corrupt and defeated consequences continue to haunt America. In societies that wish to quickly forget a war or obscure its purpose, surviving soldiers are more apparent in their grim invisibility. Returning soldiers are carriers of the disease of conscience and are more likely to be shunned rather than embraced. Many retreat into alcohol and drugs, react violently and bitterly to criticism. They are restless and are often unable to hold a job or maintain a romance. A few openly repudiate the war in which they fought. Vietnam veterans were discouraged from revealing themselves if they wished to reintegrate into the hostile, yet continually oblivious society they attempted to defend in a far-off part of the world that was claimed to be of strategic as well as ideological necessity to the United States. Soon enough, the propaganda was revealed as sham, yet few actively reflected the slowly growing public disaffection with the war. The larger population preferred to distance itself through self-hypnotic, also drug-induced, numbness, as well as repudiate an anti-war movement that defied authority to protest the continued murder and, as a number of people began to believe, the echo genocide of Vietnam life and culture. A small but significant number of Vietnam veterans organized to stop the war, which immediately triggered a pro-war military and political jihad. Neither pro-war or anti-war initially accepted or acknowledged the Vietnam veterans against the war. The anti-war accused the veterans of indiscriminate murder and of being pro-fascist personalities. They originally condemned the veterans as baby killers, an unforgiving phrase the veterans have not forgiven. The right wing, particularly such established veterans groups as the American Legion and the Veterans of Foreign Wars, assailed the VVAW as traitors and or as veteran impersonators. Each opposition to the Vietnam War had its own logic and internal history. For most anti-war veterans, it was sympathy for Vietnamese and guilt in assisting killing them. Yet some felt the war should be ended because they believed that all of Vietnam was not worth the lost life of one American. Regardless of their reasons for opposing the war they fought in, the general opinion of dissenting veterans was as turncoats, or at the very least as communist dupes who jeopardized American troops in Vietnam from the pro-war right, and genociders from the anti-war left, though both attitudes were to change. For every veteran who made known his or her protest against the war, perhaps 10 or 100 were in quiet sympathy. The anti-war movement at first rejected anti-war veterans as hopelessly guilty, and that's a quote, for having served in Vietnam in the first place. Veterans were slowly, grudgingly accepted initially as confessed lepers to otherwise be avoided, ultimately as the vanguard of anti-war activities. The attitude of the pro-war right has not changed. VVAW, even now, is accused of aiding North Vietnam as a result of its opposition to the war. Most veterans who returned from Vietnam abandoned everything military, even a group formed against it. Very few joined the American Legion or the Veterans of Foreign Wars. Ironically, the only veterans group to come out of the war opposed it. By any standards, the VVAW was a Frankenstein to the Pentagon, although the reverse side of the mirror, the antithesis to the American Legion and VFW. And although it understood the problems of Vietnam vets and gave something of a contrasting political definition to a shared negative experience, it was yet part of the same thing. The veterans who crossed political lines to oppose the war that seasoned and repelled them became immersed in leftist ideology, although many did not approve of it. Yet the political right had failed them, had inducted them into an unholy war cloaked in righteous deceit, made them prisoners of conscience. Whereas the early New Left had been inspired by the civil rights movement and embraced liberation philosophies, the veterans came to the movement angry and embittered. Most of the veterans had a limited focus that ultimately was fatal to the anti-war veterans campaign, far short of its goal to end the war. Like the majority of New Left organizations, VVAW was at first stimulated by argument, but eventually debate and disagreement degenerated into quarreling animosities that broke the group apart. The VVAW was started in the fall of 1967. The idea for the organization began during a massive anti-war demonstration in New York City that April. Six veterans marched with a large banner proclaiming Vietnam Veterans Against the War. The same banner was carried by other veterans at the Pentagon in October that year for the gigantic March Against Death. One of the vets, Jan Crum, who had been a U.S. Army advisor in South Vietnam in 1963 and later quit West Point in protest to the war his second year, envisioned the VVAW as a result of the banner's slogan. The unequivocal purpose of VVAW was to end the war and bring U.S. troops home from overseas. To that end, VVAW held two war crimes inquiries to publicly make clear the war's deception, amorality, and decimation of Vietnamese as a people and culture, but also the threat of American values the war was allegedly being fought for. The testimonies named Winter Soldier Investigation, in contrast to Sunshine Patriots, were in Washington, D.C. in December 1970 and Detroit, Michigan in February 1971. Winter Soldier was a response to the slaughter of Vietnamese civilians at My Lai in 1968, but only publicly revealed the previous year. The veterans hoped to show that although an army platoon had killed more people in a single place, the attitude toward Vietnamese generated by fear, racism, and revenge that led to My Lai was universal throughout Vietnam and the war. By the mandate of Nuremberg, military men and women are required to speak out against war crimes and other forms of injustice and wrongdoing within the military. It is usually next to impossible to do so without isolation and punishment while in uniform, and the great majority of those in VVAW waited until they were free of the military. Many in uniform were heartened by VVAW and, as a result, took a chance to speak out against Vietnam despite the risks. For most of the veterans who testified, it was the first time they had recounted their experiences in Vietnam, and for nearly all of them, it was the first opportunity they had to listen to the experiences of others who had done virtually the same things over a decade of war. And most important factor was the redundancy, the same genocidal pattern linked by men whose service in Vietnam spanned the period of American involvement. It was the first time the whole puzzle pieced itself together for each one of them, most of whom had spent not much more than a single year in country. More than 100 vets told of genocide, psychological and physical, of forced urbanization of peasants from villages, of burning and pillaging hundreds upon hundreds of villages, of wholesale defoliation of jungles and fields, of indiscriminate bombing with napalm and high fragmentation bombs, of harassment and interdiction fire by artillery every night with no particular targets, just shooting up the countryside to instill fear and carnage. And they told of free fire zones where everything that moved was fair game to be killed, no questions asked. But no one seemed to listen. The news media, for the most part, embargoed their testimony. What coverage they received was vicarious and quietly sensational in its limited coverage, calling them alleged veterans, though all of them presented their documents of legitimacy. VVAW deactivated before the Vietnam War ended. It had failed its quest to end the war, yet notably contributed to its end by defiantly acting on the collective belief that no one knows about a war better than its veterans. By the time the counterfeit government of South Vietnam collapsed and the last American left Saigon, VVAW seemed to have disappeared, but only for a while. Yet, when VVAW had been consigned to history as a single-issue aberration, its opponents and critics undoubtedly hoped would never recur. Newer wars in Central America in the 1980s and the first Persian Gulf War in the 1990s forced the apostate veterans out of languishment, and VVAW reemerged in response, recruiting newer generations of disaffected veterans. VVAW remains in existence with a solid cadre nationally of original and new members, and once again publishes its own newspaper, The Veteran, as successor to the Vietnam GI, which died with its editor-publisher, Jeff Charlotte, an early victim of Vietnam-induced disease. Vietnam Veterans Against the War was the first group of veterans formed against a war in which they fought while it was being fought, probably because the war seemed to interminably drag on for nearly a decade with more than 500,000 killed or wounded. It is not often soldiers turn against their own armies. From a very small beginning, the VVAW grew to about 20,000 members in 4 years. Not many in comparison to the 2.5 million who are accounted to have served in Vietnam, but quite enough to have become the most vital anti-war veterans group in the nation's history. A personal note, I was a member of VVAW, 1968 to 1972. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser Schalk is engineer for this program. This past Tuesday was the 500th anniversary on April 27, 1521, when a Pacific Island chief and his warriors fought a pitched battle with trespassing Spanish explorers and killed Ferdinand Magellan, whose ship's crews had to finish his circumnavigation of the earth, the first by Europeans. The chief was named Lapu Lapu. A fish is named after him, and the date of Magellan's death is a national holiday in the Philippines, the islands named after the king of their conquerors a few years after Lapu Lapu repelled Magellan's incursion. A large marker set up on the spot of Magellan's death praises the great Portuguese navigator, and the other side gives tribute to Lapu Lapu for defeating the first European intrusion in the Pacific Ocean sphere of Earth. Microphone maestro Bob Foss, the legendary megaphone of the counterculture, has joined the dead air choir of radical radio ranters at age 87. With only a couple of months of veritable yin and yang of broadcast banter are suddenly off mic and off the air. The apostle of hate radio, Rush Limbaugh, died in February, his shroud, intolerance and bigotry. And now, Bob Foss, pioneer of free-form radio, who hosted Radio Unnameable for half a century, has silently unplugged into the ether this past Saturday. He was the antithesis of hate radio. He was indeed a free-spirited, flamboyant voice of intelligence and imagination. Radio ranters do not die. They simply fade away into dead air. Tomorrow, Friday the 30th of April, is the centennial day of Just Plain Joe as President of the USA. It is also 100 days since Donald Trump has not been president. Jail awaits. And the doomsday clock remains at 100 seconds to midnight. Stay safe and lock down. Vaccinate. Remember, only we can prevent a viral apocalypse.
That's good, man.
This is Bob Fass. We're back on here with Radio Unnameable. Remember I told you about 10 minutes ago that we were going to have somebody come up? Well, it's true. Say hello.
Is it Shirley Temple?
Yeah. No, this didn't.
Come on, I don't do this to me.
What am I doing? I'm going to apologize.
Shirley Temple?
You want me to introduce you like Mike
Wallace?
This is Bob Dylan.
No. I can't say who it is?
All right. Okay.
Why don't you tell who I really am?
Well, who are you really? Put this in front of your other ear. There, that's good.
Are there any ashtrays here?
Use the floor. I'll sweep up before I go.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Hmm. All right.
This is WBAI, listener-sponsored radio in New York City. Does that impede you?
No, it doesn't impede me, but I'm looking for a chair back there. Can we get another chair, Bob?
From the crossroads of my doorstep, my eyes start to fade. And I turn my head back to the room where my love and I have laid. And I gaze back to the street, the sidewalk, and the sign. And I'm one too many mornings and 1,000 miles behind. Is a restless, hungry feeling that don't mean no one no good. When everything I'm a saying, you can say it just as good. You're right from your side, and I am right from mine. We're both just one too many mornings and 1,000 miles behind.